As I said earlier, I'm very, very thankful to be here with all of you. This church has been a part of the work that I have done for the Lord in Guatemala, but now in Philadelphia, and I'm so thankful for the fellowship that we have been able to have throughout all of these years. And it's one thing to be at the end of correspondence, and it's another thing to be here in person and getting to know you in person and eating with you. I'm looking forward to this this week. And looking forward to sharing some of the things that I've studied. Greetings from the church in Philadelphia, and also greetings from my family. We would like to be in many places at once, they were not available to be here this week, and that would be wonderful on another occasion to be here, everyone together. But they are doing well, and they send their greetings. We're going to be in Psalm 2 this morning in our sermon, Psalm 2. And I'm going to read all of the psalm if you'll follow along with me. Psalm 2. Why do the nations rage and the peoples meditate on vain things? The kings of earth take their stand and the rulers take counsel together against Yahweh and against his anointed, saying, "Let us tear their fetters apart and cast away their cords from us." He who sits in heaven laughs. The Lord mocks them. Then he speaks to them in his anger, and he terrifies them in his fury, saying, "But as for me, I have installed my king upon Zion, my holy mountain. I will surely tell the decree of Yahweh. He said to me, 'You are my son. Today I have begotten you.' Ask of me, and I will surely give the nations as an inheritance, and the ends of the earth as your possession. You shall break them with a rod of iron. You shall shatter them like a potter's vessel. So now, O kings, show insight. Take warning, O judges of the earth. Serve Yahweh with fear and rejoice with trembling. Kiss the Son, lest he become angry and you perish in the way. For his wrath will soon become kindled. How blessed are all who take refuge in him." Just a few notes about Psalm 2 before we start discussing some of its many parts. The author of this psalm is not written with the psalm itself. Many of the psalms do have a note about who wrote this psalm. For example, Psalm 3, if you look at the beginning of Psalm 3, it says Psalm 3, a psalm of David. Psalm 4 also says Psalm 4, a psalm of David. Psalm 5, a psalm of David. And so you continue on, you get the idea. There's a lot of psalms by David. But not all the psalms are by David. There are many psalms. There's some psalms. We'll notice a psalm tonight, a psalm by Moses himself. There's psalms by Solomon. There's psalms by Asaph. There are many people who have contributed to this book that we call the Book of Psalms. And in fact, there's a lot of interesting things to say about the Psalms and how these Psalms have come together to be what we have today. They were not all written at the same time. David wrote a lot of these Psalms during David's life, but there are some Psalms that we have that were written around the time of the captivity, some hundreds of years later. And then some psalms that are written after they've come back from the captivity. And so there's a lot of story, there's a lot of history that go behind these songs and these psalms, and that's important things to notice as you go throughout the Book of Psalms. But the first two books, the Book of Psalms is divided into five books. And so you notice that Psalm 1, right before in your Bibles, right before it says Psalm 1, it says the Book of Psalms, Book 1. So, whoa, there's a book. How many books are there? There's five of them. Psalm 1 begins the first book. Psalm 42, if you want to just run over there real quickly, Psalm 42 is going to begin the second book. Psalm 73 begins another book. Psalm 90, we'll see this psalm tonight. That begins the fourth book. And then later on in the week, we'll look at Psalm 107, which begins the fifth book. And so it's interesting, okay, so we have this, every hymn book, like the hymns, I thought you had hymns for worship, but you have the Psalms, hymns, spiritual songs. That's the same hymn book that we use in Philadelphia these days. But that hymn book, if you look at the beginning of your hymn book, there's a certain structure that it has, right? The first portion of that this hymn book starts with songs that are related to psalms that are in the Bible. And then there's a section that also talks about, these are songs of praise. And then there's a section that talks about the life of Jesus. And so if you look at the songbook, there's a lot of thought placed into which songs are going to go next, even in our hymn books. Same is true about the book of Psalms. It's not just that these psalms are haphazardly thrown into the book of Psalms, but they're placed in a certain order. And sometimes that order tells you something about, there's a message behind all of that. And so we'll see some of that as we go along. But here is Psalm 2. And Psalm 2, even though it's not said that David is the author of this psalm, we can know that David is the author by one thing. It is placed in the first two books. And the first two books are generally Psalms of David. And so if you look at all these psalms, Psalm 3, Psalm 4, Psalm 5, these are Psalms of David. And so that might lead us to the conclusion that it is a Psalm of David. And if there's any doubt in our minds, then we can go to the New Testament. And the New Testament reveals in chapter 4, this psalm is quoted, talking about Jesus and what he was doing. And there it says that David was the author of this psalm. All that to say that David is the author of this psalm. Sometimes it's categorized as a royal psalm, a psalm that is going to talk about the king. There are many psalms like this. In fact, we'll see another one of these psalms later on in the week. A psalm that talks about the king in Jerusalem and talks about the greatness that he has. And we'll talk about just how important that idea is in just a moment. But that's an important idea for the Jews to think about God's purpose in this man who he has placed on the throne. And as you read through here, it talks about then how Yahweh has chosen this man who has been anointed and he has been placed on the throne. And so it celebrates God's choice of this man and the power that God has put into him. He is my man. He is my anointed one. The words of the psalm, I think it's helpful if sometime you want to go back and look. In fact, let's go back and look at this. This is really important. 2 Samuel chapter 7. The words of this psalm, so much of the words here, are repeating ideas that were promised to David in 2 Samuel chapter 7. There are several chapters in the Bible that are just really, really, really important chapters. Like go back to Genesis chapter 12, promises to Abraham. That's like the backbone of the entire Old Testament story, right? 2 Samuel 7 is one of those chapters that just provides, again, part of this structure for the rest of the Old Testament story, because this is the promise to David where he is going to have a son, and not just a son, but sons that are going to be on his throne. So in 2 Samuel 7, for example, in 2 Samuel 7, and it's on the other page. Verse 12. I have it marked in my Bible. It's wrong on the wrong page. Well, it's on the right page. I just forgot which page it was on. Verse 12. When your days are fulfilled, you will lie down with your fathers, and I will raise up one of your seed after you, and who will come forth from your own body, and I will establish his kingdom, and he will build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I will be a father to him, and he will be a son to me. When he commits iniquity, I will reprove him with the rod of men and the strikes from the sons of men. But my loving kindness will not be removed from him, as I removed it from Saul, who I removed from before you. And your house and your kingdom shall endure before me forever, and your throne shall be established forever. According to all these words and according to all this vision, so Nathan spoke to David. So if you remember the context of this chapter, here is David, and he desires to build a house for God. He lives in this fancy house, and now the God of heaven lives in a tent. There's something wrong with this picture. And so he goes to God and says, I want to build this house. Nathan says, great idea. But then God turns him around and says, wait a minute. You go back to him and says, you're not going to be the one to build this temple. It's going to be your son. And so basically there, what he has here is he's saying, David, you're not going to build my temple, but you're going to have a son. You wanted to build a house for me, but in reality, I'm going to build a house for you. I'm going to build this house for you, and I'm going to build this dynasty. This is the promise of a dynasty that he's going to have. And this, the, one of this, this his children is going to build this house. And but then he promises that he's going to be in on your kingdom, and your house will endure forever. There's a lot of questions that sometimes we have about these verses. Who is he talking about? Is he talking about Solomon? Well, surely he is talking about Solomon, because Solomon comes along, and what does he do? God establishes his throne, and then God comes along and allows him to build a temple, and his kingdom is established for a long time. But then what happens to this promise after that? Solomon understands that this promise is about him. Notice with me in 1 Kings 8. I'm going to run over here as well. In 1 Kings chapter 8, Solomon, once he finally does build this temple, and he recognizes that these promises that God had made to David were being fulfilled right now. And so he says in 1 Kings chapter 8, and in verse 17, he says, it was in the heart of David, my father, to build a house for the name of Yahweh, the God of Israel. But Yahweh said to my father David, because it is in your heart to build the house for my name, you did well. It was in your heart. Nevertheless, you shall not build the house, but your son, who will come forth from your loins, he will build the house for my name. And Yahweh has established his word, which he has spoken, and I have been established in place of my father David, and sit on the throne of Israel as Yahweh has promised, and I have built the house of the house for the name of Yahweh, the God of Israel. Solomon sure seems to think that he is the fulfillment of this promise, doesn't he? This is what God said to my father David, and now I'm fulfilling it. I'm building this house. But even Solomon understands that this promise is bigger than just Solomon. It's bigger than just Solomon. In fact, this promise that David's house would be sitting on the throne and established on the throne was about Solomon as the next anointed one. David was anointed with oil. You remember that idea? Then Solomon was anointed with oil. Then later on, who else was going to be anointed with oil? Oh, Rehoboam, his son, and all of the sons of David who come after him, who are going to sit on the throne of David, those were going to be these anointed ones throughout the generations. In fact, here in 1 Kings chapter 8 and in verse 25, notice the ideas that Solomon has here. He says, God, you fulfilled your promises in me. Now keep on fulfilling your promises to continual generations. He says in verse 25, so now, Yahweh, the God of Israel, keep with your servant David, my father, that which you have promised him, saying, you shall not have a man cut off from before me who is to sit on the throne of Israel, if only your sons keep their way to walk as you have walked before me. And so there is this idea that God is not going to cut off this lineage. God is not going to cut off these sons. It's going to be forever. This throne is going to belong to David and David's house forever. So as you go through the story of the Bible, story of the Old Testament, David, of course, he's the great king. Solomon, he's a great king, but he has a lot of mistakes. And then finally, when Rehoboam, the grandson, comes along, he has a lot more mistakes, and the kingdom is divided up. A son of David does remain on the throne there in Jerusalem for a long, long time. Then finally, because of the sins of the people, the sins of the kings, they're turning to idolatry, then God comes and punishes them. And he takes away the people out of Jerusalem, destroys the temple, destroys Jerusalem, and takes away the throne. Now everybody's in captivity. And so that's kind of the end where a lot of this goes into captivity. And one of the big questions that the people of Israel have while they're in captivity is exactly about this promise. What happened to the promise to David? You promised God that we were going to have David on the throne forever, his children on the throne forever. But what happened? And so this is the idea then that even after the captivity, that people are searching and wanting to know, where is the promise of this anointed one? In terms of Hebrew, the question is, where is this Messiah who is coming? That's what Messiah means, is the anointed one. Or in Greek, Christ. Here's this Christ who is coming. So it's this idea that David's lineage needs to continue on. God has promised it's going to be forever. But now what do we do with the captivity? We get to come back from the captivity, but we still don't have the king. What's going to happen? Where is the Messiah? Where is the Christ? And so finally, all of these promises, 2 Samuel chapter 7, 1 Kings chapter 8, Psalm 2, all of these then are finally fulfilled in the one Messiah, the one Christ, who the whole world has been waiting for, and that is Jesus, who is the Christ. I hope I've summed that up in a way that you can understand. That's just a really important idea. These passages, 2 Samuel chapter 7, is like the backbone of the rest of the Old Testament. And this hope for a Messiah is just really important to understand. When we go into captivity, it's not just that we're losing our heritage and our lands. Yes, that's important. But we're losing the Messiah. We're losing the king. And that king is the one who brings us success. Where is he? And then finally, God comes with his king, Jesus. I want you to think about Psalm 2 in this light. I think Psalm 2 is probably a psalm that was thought of by David in the beginning to think about these promises. There's so many of these promises the wording of Psalm 2, so much of the words from Psalm 2 are repetitions from the ideas from 2 Samuel 7. And so, in other words, Psalm 2 is a celebration of God's choice of his Messiah, of his anointed one in this earthly king there in Jerusalem. And it celebrates these earthly kings that God chooses. It's celebrating his choice in that. But then, of course, as time goes on, and now us as Christians, we look forward to whatever fulfillment we could find of this psalm then in, say, Rehoboam or Hezekiah or Josiah. Really, the ultimate fulfillment of any of these psalms or any of the prophecies is going to find its way into Jesus, who is the Messiah, the Anointed One, the Christ. So this psalm, even though it's written in terms of an earthly king, and probably thought of by David originally about as in the context of this earthly king, we as Christians can really relate to this psalm, because we also have a king. We also have a king, and we need to understand how God has chosen him. So Psalm 2 has immediate application in Kings of Jerusalem, but its ultimate fulfillment is going to find its way in our life today. So Psalm 2 begins, though, with a problem. There's this huge problem. It says in verse 1 that all the nations are raging. They're raging against who? In verse 2, against Yahweh, against his anointed. I think the picture that we have here, if you could just illustrate this in your mind, is if here is Jerusalem, and all the nations of the earth are gathered up against the king there in Jerusalem. That's a pretty startling or pretty fearful picture, isn't it? All the nations raging against God and raging against his purposes. But how does the psalmist open up the first line? He asks the questions. He asks the question, why? Why? Why did the peoples meditate on a vain thing? So you could just imagine your house. What if here is your house and you're sitting in your house and all of a sudden, I don't know, all of the thieves and robbers and all the bad people of Burnett, probably no bad people in Burnett, but they come up to your house and they've gathered around your house. How would you feel about that? I would be terrified. Wait, could you imagine that? That would be terrifying. But the psalmist walks out and he looks at all this crowd and he says, what are they doing? What are these guys, what do they think they're doing? Because what are they doing? They have gathered, they have taken their stands, the rulers have taken counsel together against whom? Against Yahweh and against his anointed. You know, one could think that this might make sense if they were, if this were a normal king and if they were going up just against this human. But this is not just a normal king. This is the anointed one of God. This is the one that God has chosen. He is the Messiah of God. What do they think they're doing? Is the question of the psalmist. But you can see what they are doing, and you can see by their motive in verse 3. He says, let us tear their fetters apart. Let us cast away their cords from us. What is their desire? Their desire is to no longer have the shackles of the king over them. If we're thinking about the human king there in Jerusalem, I think we can see this in the context. David, for example, when he would destroy or when he would defeat these nations around him, he would defeat them, and then they would have to pay tribute. They would become his slaves. Edom, for example, and Moab would be these nations around Jerusalem that would pay tribute to the king there in Jerusalem. But there would be times when finally they would try to shake off those shackles, shake off those fetters. And so the idea here is that, what do they think they're doing? How is it that they think they can do this? I think it's important, though, to see that this is not just a problem that if we think about this in the bigger scheme of things, this is not just a problem that they had in the 8th century BC Jerusalem. But in reality, this is also something that describes the attitude of the world against our Messiah, against our king who is in heaven. Isn't this the world, the desire that the world has? Tearing off the fetters, tearing off the cords. Let us get away from God. Let us get away from Jesus, our Messiah. So much of the world is calling on people just, you know, no one can tell me what to do, thinking that this is the way that I can be free and I can live my life. We talked about looking for true happiness. No one can tell me what I can do with my own body. No one can tell me, you know, what gender I am. No one can tell me what I can do with my life. Thinking that by these things we can have true freedom. I'll put a finger there in Psalm 2 for a moment and look with me at 1 Peter, or 2 Peter chapter 2. In 2 Peter chapter 2, I think it's important to see that when someone has this attitude, and when someone breaks their bonds, runs away from God, indeed they get away from God. But it's not that they get freedom as a result. Rather, what one gets when they run away from God is further slavery into a a slaveholder that does not have our good in his mind. And then notice in 2 Peter chapter 2. 2 Peter chapter 2, and I'll start in verse 17. This is a section that's talking about some of the false teachers and how the Christians need to be warned of them. But he says in 2 Peter chapter 2 and verse 17, these are springs without water and mists driven by a storm, for whom the black darkness has been kept. For speaking out arrogant words of vanity, they entice by sensual lust of the flesh those who barely escape from the ones who conducted themselves in error. So what are they doing? They're calling to people and saying, listen, if you follow us, look at all the pleasures that you can have. And so like springs, there are these springs, come and follow us and you can have these lush waters, but they're springs without water. They're mists driven by a storm. And so now in verse 19, they are promising what? They're promising freedom, while they themselves are slaves of corruption. For by what a man is overcome, by this he is enslaved. You can run from God, but you're not running to freedom. Rather, you're running to slavery. You're becoming enslaved by sin. And so here are these individuals, and they have this desire to cast off the fetters of Yahweh, cast off the shackles of the Anointed One. Leave us alone. But they don't know, one, they don't know what they're doing. And two, they don't know that this is a vain thing. Notice what he says in verse 4, going back to Psalm 2. In Psalm 2, so you have this image in verses 1 through 3. The nations are raging. The psalmist says, why are they doing this? What is God's reaction from heaven? It says in verse 4, he who sits in heaven laughs. The Lord mocks them. Does God ever laugh? Does God ever have a sense of humor? Yeah, this is not exactly the sense of humor that I would particularly like to hear from God. I would not like to hear this type of laugh from God. This is a mocking laugh. In fact, there are a couple other places in the Psalms where it talks about God's laugh. I'm not going to go and read these places, but Psalm 37, verse 3, Psalm 59, and verse 8. And each time it talks about this laugh of God, it is a menacing laugh where people have become so rebellious. They are against God. But God says, guys, you can't do this against me. There's nothing you can do against me. It's a type of humor when you think of, it's almost like, you know, you, I don't know, if the illustration I have here is, you know, how do you fight against the God of heaven? How is it even possible? What kind of axe are you going to use? What kind of sword are you going to use? How does a goldfish swallow a whale? It's even humorous even thinking about it. It's like this, think of this, a cartoon of a goldfish coming along, swallowing. It's impossible. That even makes you laugh. It makes God laugh. How dare they even think that this is possible? No one can fight against God. This reminds me of the words of Gamaliel in Acts chapter 5. Acts chapter 5, you remember the context where the apostles have been arrested and they've been taken before the Sanhedrin. And while he says a lot of things in this that maybe we would agree with or disagree with, but especially in his final judgment in verse 38, what he does realize that is absolutely correct is we don't want to be found fighting against God. He says in verse 38, so in the present case, I also say to you, stay away from these men and let them alone. For if this plan or action is from men, it will be overthrown. But if it is from God, you will not be able to overthrow them. Or you may even be found fighting against God. It's like the worst thing that you could ever do, fight against God. Because why? Because you can't do it. So here is this God in heaven, and he laughs at those who want to take aim at him, to take aim against him, and also against who? against his anointed. Because when God has chosen something, no one can change it. And so in verse 5, it says that he shows his wrath. This must be a fearful thing. In verse 5, he speaks to them in his anger. He terrifies them in his fury, saying, "But as for me, I have installed my king upon Zion." Zion is another word for Jerusalem. "On my holy mountain." He installs his king, and not only does he install his king, he expresses the personal relationship that he has. Again, repeating ideas from 2 Samuel chapter 7. "I will surely tell the decree of Yahweh. He said to me, 'You are my son. Today I have begotten you.'" There is a special relationship that the king of Jerusalem had because he, God said, "I would treat him as my son." But of course, when we get to the New Testament, this idea of Jesus being the Messiah, he becomes the Son of God in a much greater way than any king who was on the throne of Jerusalem. In fact, these words, while there might be some fulfillment in the Israelite king, the ultimate reference is to the Messiah in this very unique way. And so Jesus, when we get to the New Testament, Jesus is declared, he is the Son of God. How is he declared the Son of God? One way he is declared the Son of God is in the resurrection. Romans chapter 1 and verse 4, he is declared the Son of God by the resurrection. God raised him from the dead and said, "I am his Father. He is my Son. He is the chosen one because I did this for him." There are other moments in the life of Jesus when Jesus was declared the Son of God. For example, in Luke chapter 3, verses 21 to 22, it talks about Jesus at his baptism, how he was called the Son of God. You remember the occasion where the Father speaks from heaven, the Holy Spirit comes down in the form of a dove, and Jesus is there being baptized, and what are the words? "This is my Son." It's interesting that then after being declared the Son of God, that when the devil takes him away out into the wilderness, the devil begins to tempt Jesus. And one of the temptations that he uses in chapter 4 and verse 5, he says, chapter 4 and verse 5, he says he led him away and he showed him all the kingdoms of the world in a moment of time. And the devil says, if I will give you all this dominion and its glory, for it has been handed over to me, and I will give it to whomever I wish. So the devil takes him and shows him all the nations. Which is interesting because Psalm 2 talks about this idea that is promised to the Messiah. He is going to receive the nations. So he's declared the Son of God, and then the devil says, "I'll give you all the nations." It becomes kind of a question. So why is the devil offering this to Jesus if it's already promised that he's going to receive it? Why would that be a temptation? Jesus can say, I'm already going to receive this. This is not a temptation. And I think that the idea that is here in many of the temptations of Jesus that we have here is that the devil is tempting him by giving him a shortcut. That's exactly what the devil did with Eve, and the devil does even with us today. He says, "Oh yeah, God wants you to have that, but he wants you to wait. He wants you to go through hard things. He wants you to go through, in Jesus' case, he wants you to go through the cross first. You don't have to do that. Just fall down, worship me, and I'll give you all of these things." So often what the devil tempts us with are twists of the things that God has already promised to us. If we have patience and allow him to fulfill his word to us. But the main thing is that here is Jesus, and he's being declared the Son of God, just as it was prophesied there in Psalm 2. It's also interesting to note, in Psalm 2 and verse 9, it talks about that the Anointed One would rule with a rod of iron. We're not going to go to these verses, but then in Revelation chapter 12, Revelation chapter 19, Revelation chapter 21, all talk about this idea of Jesus ruling with a rod of iron. And I'm just putting these verses up here partly just to say, look how important Psalm 2 is for the writers in the New Testament. Just Psalm 2 is full of references to what Jesus was going to do. Psalm 2 speaks of this Messiah who God chooses, and he chooses and installs him on his throne, and there's nothing that anyone can do to remove him from there. I think that helps us to appreciate who Jesus is. If we understand what God thinks of Jesus in the Old Testament, it helps us then when we get to the New Testament to understand the magnitude of God's promises and how great and how mighty he is, even in the New Testament. Psalm 2 and verse 10. So Psalm 2, verses 1 through 3, we have this problem. The nations are raging. Everyone's going crazy. Let's get away from Yahweh. Let's cast off the shackles. Verses 4 through 9, here's the reaction of God. He laughs at them. There's nothing that they can do. There's no enemy that can stand against me. And in fact, look at what I have done to my anointed one. I have made him my son. I have made him to sit on this throne, and he will rule with a rod of iron. So then what we have in verses 10 through 12 is this call to action, is what I'm going to call it. A call to action. An invitation to, why don't you change your tune? So he says in verse 10, for example, in Psalm 2 in verse 10, so now, O kings, show insight. In other words, you better wise up here. Take warning, O judges of the earth. Serve Yahweh with fear and rejoice with trembling. Kiss the Son, lest he become angry and you perish in the way, for his wrath may soon become kindled. How blessed are all who take refuge in him. It seems like the psalmist is looking at all these nations who are surrounding Jerusalem and giving them an invitation to say, you might want to change your raging here. You might want to think about this another time, because God is going to destroy you if you don't. Here's what I suggest, O kings. This is what I give to you as wisdom, O judges of the earth. You need to serve God with fear and trembling, it says in verse 11. Serve God with fear and rejoice with trembling. I like these ideas in verse 11 where it talks about us worshiping Yahweh with reverence and rejoicing with him and with trembling. That's an odd mix for me to think about. That we rejoice before God with trembling. It is many times the case that we emphasize one part of God, one characteristic of God, to a fault. Am I saying that correctly? Well, we don't emphasize other parts of his character. We emphasize maybe his love. God is a God of love. We need to emphasize the fact that he is a God of love. God is a God of grace. God is a God of forgiveness. God is a God who loves us so much and wants to invite us in. But God is also what? He is a God of wrath. A God who is willing to show his wrath. And a God that needs to be reverenced, even if we are his children. Does that make sense? Sometimes we come before God and we emphasize so much that he is this God of grace and that he's invited us into his presence, but we never need to forget of the sheer power that our God possesses within his hand to destroy the whole world or to raise us up on high. This is the God that we serve, rejoicing that we can be in his presence, but rejoicing with trembling and reverence. Let us never forget that the only reason that we can come into the presence of God is because there is one who died for our sins to make us whole. And that because of that, and through that high priest, we can come before him. God is a great God. We need to revere him and treat him with such respect. But it's not just Yahweh on high. But also he says, you need to treat my son with respect. So it says in verse 12, you need to... The version that I'm using here has a different... May has a different note than yours, but it says, kiss the son. Kiss the son, lest he become angry. And I like that picture. It's almost like this picture of, you know, what is it that you do when you've found that you are at odds with someone who is very, very powerful? What do you do? You don't just come in and say, oh, hey, sorry, man. Ran over your roses again, sorry. That's not just, that belittles then the power of the individual. When we understand who this anointed one is, then that he has the power as well to say what's going to happen to us. What is our attitude? Oh, we come before him and we grab his hand and we kiss his hand. Does that make sense? You kiss his hand and you show your reverence to him. You seek his pardon. You seek his pleasure. Kiss the son, lest he become angry and you perish in the way. For his wrath may soon become kindled. So in other words, here is this Messiah who also, here, you think of Jesus. Jesus is he is this man of love. He is a man of humility. He's a man who has patience with so many people. But he is also the anointed one of God. And those who do not bow the knee, those who do not obey the gospel of Jesus Christ, will be destroyed. And so it is, the final words of this psalm, blessed are those who take refuge in him. I think it's interesting how the book of Psalms begins. It begins with a note, blessed are those who listen to Yahweh, who listen to God, and listen and delight in his word day and night. He's inviting them to listen to these things, but that also, one of the huge themes of the book of Psalms, blessed also are those who take refuge in his promises. Blessed are those who take refuge in the anointed one. That is a huge message for us as Christians today. I want to give you just one application that I think is really necessary for us. We get worried, don't we? I don't know about you, but I get worried all the time. And we worry about everything, about the direction that our society is going. We worry about our society and how politically it's getting corrupt. We worry about our society and how it's changing culturally. We worry about what educationally, what they're teaching in school nowadays. We worry about the economy. We worry about this and worry about that. And we say everything is just going against with the way it should be. In fact, it seems that everybody in this world seems to have taken up arms against Yahweh and against his anointed one. We find ourselves then in our worries in verses 1 through 3. But these verses ought to give us courage to know that whatever happens, God has installed his anointed one on the throne, and no one is going to take him off. God has chosen his son. He has declared him the son of God, and he will rule with a rod of iron. Blessed are those who take refuge in him. In fact, this is the way that Christians in the first century used this psalm. Look with me in Acts chapter 4. Acts chapter 4. I find it just very interesting that in Acts chapter 4, here's here in the context Peter and John had been taken away and been put into prison, and now they have been let out. But the first thing that they do is they go and they gather with other Christians, and they begin to pray to God in thanksgiving that they have allowed them to come out of the prison and be freed from all of this. And so it says in here in Acts chapter 4 and in verse 23. I'll start reading in verse 23. It says, "So that when they were released, they went to their own companions and reported all that the chief priests and the elders had said to them. And when they heard this, they lifted up their voices to God with one accord and said, 'O Master, it is you who made the heaven and the earth and the sea and all that is in them, who by the Holy Spirit, through the mouth of our father David, your servant, said, why did the Gentiles rage, or the nations rage, and the peoples devise vain things? The kings of earth took their stand, and the rulers gathered against the Lord and against his Christ," against his anointed one. "For truly in this city, they were gathered together against your holy servant, Jesus, whom you anointed, both Herod and Pontius Pilate, along with the Gentiles and the peoples of Israel, to do whatever your hand and your purpose predestined to occur." They're making connections then with what was said in the Old Testament, that the nations would rage. Say how appropriate this is now, because the nations literally were raging. The Pilate, these Gentiles raging against God and raging against his purpose. Even the Jews raging against his purposes. But God was not going to allow that to topple his plans in one way. So now look at the verses in verse 29. This is finally their petition in verse 29. "O now, Lord, take notice of their hearts and grant that your slaves may speak your word with all confidence, while you extend your hand to heal and your signs and wonders happen through the name of your holy servant, Jesus." And when they had prayed earnestly, the place where they were gathered together was shaken, and they were all filled with the Holy Spirit and began to speak the word of God with confidence. What a powerful moment. But I think it's amazing to see the attitude of these brethren. They look back and they say, "We are going through some hard things." Could you imagine this? If some of the brethren here, maybe Daryl and Jim, are taken away and they're locked up for the night, how would that make all of us feel? Wow, if they're locked up for the night because they're Christians, I'm also a Christian, I might be next. If I were a Christian during this time, what would be my petition? Oh God, take away these persecutors. Oh God, change, give us peace so that we don't have to worry about these persecutions. I think it is significant that these Christians, they see that these are the nations. They are raging against God. But you know what they do? They do not ask for relief from the persecutions. They do not ask for relief from the pain. But rather, what do they ask for? God, give us confidence to speak and to work despite all of it. May God give us confidence then in our Messiah as well, who God has installed upon the throne of glory. If we are Christians, we can take refuge in him despite whatever this world does against us, against his anointed, or against our Father in heaven. If you are not a Christian, let me end with these words to you as well. Psalm 2 and verse 10. "O now, O kings, show insight. Take warning, O judges of the earth. Serve Yahweh with fear and rejoice with trembling. He is the one to serve. kiss the Son, lest he become angry and you perish in the way. For his wrath will soon become kindled. How blessed are all who take refuge in him. Will you take refuge in the Anointed One, in Jesus the Nazarene, who died for you? I hope we can encourage all of us to do that same thing. Let's think about these things as we stand and sing the final song.